we're going to give you the last word again tonight.
Thank you. You know, talking about Rosa Parks, I always forget. I mean, it's so easy for me to get very narrow in my thinking. I don't see beyond this country. I don't see the struggles in this country as really just being part of a struggle around the world. And there's one incident in Rosa Parks' life that apparently meant a whole lot to her. And when I read it a number of years ago, it meant a lot to me. And in honor of Rosa Parks, in the early 90s, she's living in Detroit. She'd stopped working for Congressman Conyers, so she was kind of forgotten. And Nelson Mandela was coming to town. I think it was his first American visit after being set free. And he was making a stop on his U.S. tour. He was making a stop in Detroit. No one bothered to invite Rosa Parks. And she knew Mandela was coming, and she kind of was hoping someone would invite her to be part of the welcoming thing. And finally, someone said, oh, yeah, let's invite her. And so Nelson Mandela gets off the plane, and of course the crowd goes wild, and he comes down the steps, and as he's coming down the steps, he looks at this welcoming line, and his eyes go to Rosa Parks, and he walks direct, and Rosa Parks has never, met this man, he's a world hero, but he goes right up to her and stands right in front of her and grabs her, and he says to her, he starts chanting, Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks.
Wow.
Rosa Parks. And what he later shared was that during 55, when this thing happened in America, in Montgomery, in South Africa, this was utterly empowering. And there were black in the streets in South Africa chanting, Rosa Parks, Rosa Parks, Rosa Parks. So, I mean, it really kind of blew her away, because even with all her fame, and to realize the impact that her life had on people across the world, it was really something.
Thank you very much, Curtis. I had never heard that, and that's really, get chills.
This is the second year that Dr. John Marciano has led a popular study group considering Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Dr. Marciano is Emeritus Professor, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. In 2004, he began the series at the now-departed Midnight Special Bookstore in Santa Monica. The series now continues at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. Every month, this group meets to discuss the assigned reading, individual chapters in people's history. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. The following recording by the LA Sound Posse was done on November 15th of 2005. It contains John's commentary on chapters 17, Asking or Does It Explode, and chapter 19, Surprises.
Okay, talking tonight about chapter 17 and chapter 19, or Does It Explode, essentially, but the rise of the black liberation, civil rights, human rights struggle in the country, not just African Americans, evidently, others as well, but that's what Zinn concentrates on. And then Surprises, chapter 19, that chapter discusses the resurgence of the women's movement, struggles within prisons, but I'm just going to focus my comments on the issue of gender equality and the rise of the women's liberation movement, often connected to the 60s, but really explodes in the 70s, much more than the 60s, despite so many people thinking that, it was Betty Friedan that started it all with the feminine mystique. So the notion of some people being surprised about what emerged in the 1950s and 1960s about the black revolt, but Zinn, of course, arguing that really if people had an understanding of what was happening, especially after World War II, that they should not have been surprised. And a lot of this, of course, was resurrected just a few weeks ago with the death of Rosa Parks, with enough distorted history from George Bush and other people to make you throw up in terms of her real role. And he stated that she was one of the great, great heroes of American history. And I actually sent a short letter to my former hometown paper in Ithaca, New York, pointing out that for those who share Bush's conservative philosophy, that if you actually go back to what happened in Montgomery, Alabama, and go back and learn about Rosa Parks' life and her involvement in the NAACP, and her involvement with a Highlander folk school in Tennessee. She was an activist. She wasn't just somebody who was tired that day. That conservatives, virtually to a person, opposed everything she stood for, everything that the civil rights movement stood for, and they continued to support right through the 60s and beyond the miscegenation laws in the South, which by state laws forbid blacks and whites from marrying each other, which was overturned by the Supreme Court. So people can have amnesia about the 50s and 60s, especially around this certainly very principled and courageous person. It's clear from Zinn, it should be clear in terms of other histories, that the struggles of the 50s and 60s were built on decades of struggle that went before, which involved certainly blacks mainly, some whites, involved communists and other radicals, fueled by returning World War II and Korean War vets who were not about to tolerate a continuation of racist violence against blacks and other oppressed racial minorities. The struggles, the conflicts that veterans especially faced going back to the South were absolutely extraordinary. Zinn shares a few of poetic moments from Langston Hughes, his What Happens to a Dream Deferred, and his I Too Sing America, with its powerful line, "Tomorrow I'll be at the table when company comes." It seems to me the thrust, of course, being what actually happened to those who were oppressed in the country and some white allies. Very, very few in the South. I'm sure if we were to go back and follow this movement and what actually happened in the 50s and 60s, there are going to be all sorts of public officials in the South and others who are going to claim that they were allies of this struggle. But when you actually go back to the 50s and 60s in the South, you find out that very, very few Anglo-Americans, European-Americans stuck their necks out on behalf of this struggle. And as much as we may admire Martin Luther King, he was savaged by white clergy in the South and white politicians. People forget that. So it goes back to that great statement by Frederick Douglass that the changes were forced. The changes came from people organizing who were oppressed and forced people in power to shift. That is, those in power in the South and the rest of the country did not, for the most part, shift because of a moral revulsion of what was happening. Not about lynching in the earlier decades, not about what happened in Mississippi to the three civil rights workers, not about thousands of blacks losing their jobs and being arrested. It was never about moral revulsion over racist policies. He spends a little time talking about the author Richard Wright, talks about a fact in U.S. history that most people, of course, because we all grew up, especially those of us post-World War II in a very strong anti-communist society, that is the total ignorance about the role of the Communist Party, black and white, in the South, especially around racial equality. No other white group in the country, not the Quakers, not the Socialists, not the Democrats, etc., fought harder on behalf of racial injustice in the country. And he spends a little bit of time talking about those, of course, who were either allied with the left or became communists, as W.E.B. Du Bois did at the end of his life. And of course, Paul Robeson, though in a marvelous biography on Robeson by Martin Duberman, Duberman argues that Paul Robeson was never in the Communist Party, but he certainly was very sympathetic and was close friends with Benjamin Davis, who up through the 1940s represented Harlem in the New York City Council. Up through the 40s in New York, there were actually two communists in the city council, one Italian-American from Brooklyn and Benjamin Davis from Harlem. And of course, Robeson and Du Bois and King, in a different way, in a different time, were vilified and persecuted for their radical views, especially for refusing to participate in the McCarthyite hysteria that developed after World War II, which started before tail gunner Joe McCarthy waived his list in 1950. It started with the loyalty programs under Truman. There have been some marvelous books, by the way, published in the last 5 to 10 years on the whole connection of racism to the Cold War by Mary Dudziak, who's a professor at USC, by Brenda Plummer, who's at, I believe, the University of Wisconsin, Penny Von Eschen, who's at the University of Michigan, Thomas Bortelson, Borstelman, who's at Cornell, all around the themes of race and civil rights, arguing that it was the international climate in the world and the pressure by the rising anti-colonial movements and the rising independent countries in Asia and Africa, and the Cold War contest between the Soviet Union and the United States that dramatically pushed and forced people in power in this country to shift somewhat regarding blacks, especially in the United States, having far too many embarrassing moments of diplomats from black countries in Africa coming to the United States and not being served when they, for example, would be going back and forth from the UN in New York to Washington on the highway. Marvelous, serious scholarship that you might want to look up. And I'm pretty sure I have those books on the list that I sent around. Same way, it's not an accident that after World War II and in the midst of the Cold War and in the rising anti-colonial movement in the country that President Truman moves to desegregate the armed forces of the United States. I just discovered, actually, by doing some research, he did it on my 8th birthday, July 26, 1948. And there's actually a marvelous stamp. There's a wonderful series of stamps put out by the post office. There are 10 stamps, and it has this executive orders, one of the stamps. The Selma March is the other one among them, the March on Washington. Though nothing about the Tuskegee Airmen. I was talking to a friend, Ed Tillman, who was in our group, and he's actually president of the Los Angeles chapter of the Tuskegee Airmen. He said, for 8-10 years now, they've been trying to get the post office to honor the Tuskegee Airmen with a stamp, which they haven't done. Yet, I know someone in Chicago who worked for 2 or 3 years, went around the country and actually got the post office to honor Paul Robeson with a stamp. And I was amazed. And of course, there's a really fine stamp out of Langston Hughes, James Baldwin, Miriam Anderson. So the international climate again, I mean, think about this. The U.S. fights for democracy against fascism and racism in World War II with a segregated armed forces. So Truman does this 4 months before he's reelected in 1948. Same way with the famous Brown versus Board of Education decision, Topeka, Kansas, 1954, May 17th, a unanimous decision. There was some politicking on the Supreme Court. As kids, what do we know? I mean, you hear that the Supreme Court made this decision, and then you find out, of course, as you get older and you read that these guys are almost bidding back and forth. You know, I'll give you two high draft choices if you vote for this decision. It had to be unanimous. In 1954, the Cold War is still on. The, again, anti-colonial, anti-imperialist sentiment in the world. The rising third world. It's a year before the non-aligned countries meet in Bandung, Indonesia. Imagine if it had not been a unanimous decision, or if the Supreme Court in the United States had decided that apartheid in education was still constitutional and had ratified the Plessy versus Ferguson decision of 1897, the United States would have been the laughingstock of the world. There's no way they could have gone anywhere in the world. That issue, even though the Supreme Court allowed southern states to get off the hook by then passing a decision about all deliberate speed, and where virtually every southern state, except for certain pockets, did everything they could, including starting white Christian academies to keep their schools segregated. There's some discussion of the whole issue around nonviolence in King, as opposed to the issues raised by veteran Robert Williams in North Carolina, who had to eventually flee the country, ended up in Cuba, for urging blacks to arm themselves in Monroe, North Carolina, and to defend themselves against the attacks of the KKK. People went crazy. Blacks are arming themselves. And this is after decades and decades and decades and centuries of lynching, burning churches, bombing, threatening. Then a few people begin to pick up arms, and a lot of white folks went absolutely nuts. Not that they were so pleased with all the nonviolent students in the South, for example, in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who used to guard black churches with their hands and their spirits, with no guns, no sticks, etc., and were still thought to be outside agitators, sort of part of the, I remember hearing people in the 60s when I was in the civil rights movement working actually in upstate New York, talking about these black students were part of the Jew communist conspiracy. And you could tell because they were people, they wanted to have equality between the races. So, I mean, the whole issue of violence, nonviolence, it often it's paired off with Martin Luther King and Malcolm X in that whole debate, which, for those of you who have heard some of Malcolm's great speeches that he made in the 60s before he was killed or read his autobiography, his argument was that, in a sense, by all means necessary, but urging that people could do all different kinds of things for their freedom, but that black people had a sacred right to defend themselves. Brief discussion of the spark of the four college students at North Carolina A&T in Greensboro in February 1960, and what that triggered in the South and throughout the country, and how that had an amazing impact on those of us who were young college students at the time. People ended up picketing Woolworths all over the country. The rise of the Congress for Racial Equality talks about Bob Moses, Robert Paris Moses, who's still involved in a program to teach kids, especially ghetto kids, mathematics. He was a Harvard graduate. And the reality, and we have to remember this because we look back, especially at the Kennedys with rose-colored glasses, we forget, for example, that Robert Kennedy was an aide on Senator McCarthy's subcommittee during the 50s. We forget that both John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy were quite timid in responding to this nonviolent movement in the South. Kennedy went to Berlin, to the Berlin Wall, and pledged his solidarity with the people of Berlin, but he never went to Mississippi and pledged his solidarity with black people when Southern governors and senators were thumbing their noses at the federal government. Their hands were forced. They were never in front of this movement. They were always behind it. They were never, never in front of this movement, despite all the media and historical narratives we get. No black suffering in protest in Birmingham, and no black girls dead in the bombing in that city on September 15, 1963. That doesn't happen. You don't get very eloquent speeches by JFK about freedom and justice and democracy. So you got the image and the reality of the Kennedys and their role, which does change in a substantive way. I think it's very clear if you listen to the speeches that Robert Kennedy made in the 2 months or so that he had left in his life after Martin Luther King was killed, that he was clearly, certainly in addition to his own brother's death, and I think had Robert Kennedy not been assassinated here in Los Angeles in June 68, that he would have been president. So he clearly was moving in a progressive direction. The discussion of Freedom Summer, the murder of the three civil rights workers, Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner. Again, sort of reality and myth in various film, the film that Gene Hackman was in about the FBI in Mississippi, which is butchered a job of history, as you're going to find. The FBI essentially did nothing to support the rights of black people in the South. That issue, more than any other issue of that time, really propelled me into the movement for peace and social justice, because I had been married the Saturday, that weekend that those three young men were killed. And I remember that, you know, the first sunrise we saw on June 21st, 1964 was the last sunrise they saw, and then they were killed. And I remember just, you know, it was almost enough to drive you mad, saying, you know, as if this can't happen in the United States. Well, you know, I'm young, I'm naive, we're idealistic, and we don't know enough about U.S. history. If we did, then we would understand it. The same way with Lyndon Johnson. There was a revolutionary movement unfolding in the United States. He didn't want to move beyond the modest measures that Kennedy had proposed, but the events pushed him. And in some way, he rose to the occasion. But Lyndon doesn't say we shall overcome in the Congress of the United States before the American people without the marches in the South and the deaths and the struggles and the thousands and thousands and thousands of people arrested. Again, he was behind this movement, not in front of it. Malcolm, of course, always there, the symbol of Malcolm X. The comments he made about the March on Washington, in which the administration tried to block and then to organize. There were thousands of federal troops in Washington, D.C. on August 28, 1963. They were worried about rioting. And then, of course, the thousands of troops would be back in D.C. during anti-war marches. And then on April 4th and beyond in 1968, when King was killed, the riots in the cities that emerged at that time, in Detroit, in Newark, of course here in Los Angeles, in Watts, Rochester, New York, where I was actually working at the time, the changing mood among young blacks in the country, the rise of black power, and the outrage of white people, and especially political officials in the country, to the increasing militants in cities that we're noticing as being repeated as we speak in France. I sent an email to a friend of mine who's lived in France since 1984, asking him to fill me in on what was happening. And he said, just think Detroit, 1968. He said the same thing, massive unemployment, racism, cops, etc. I mean, all the fuel, well, everything was there. And of course, as we now know, increasing involvement in those struggles, militant struggles in the cities, and in the rising Black Panther Party that involved black veterans and Latino veterans coming back from Vietnam, all of whom had been trained to use weapons and got involved politically. The greatest threat, of course, as J. Edgar Hoover articulated it in the officials, was that a black messiah would arise to really organize black people. And beyond that, the greatest fear, of course, is that someone like King or Malcolm might bring blacks and whites together in a movement that would go for, you know, think of racial justice and equality and changing the conditions in the country with jobs and hope, absolute, especially bringing white and black working people together. So Malcolm was the spokesman for the more militant wing, followed by Stokely Carmichael, H. Rapp Brown. And of course, there were excesses and accusations made, but I think what Zinn's trying to show is that they should not blind us to the historical context, and we need to understand why the more militant wing of the black movement arose, which harkened back to John Brown and the militant abolitionist struggles in the 19th century. Of course, the assassination of King and the resulting riots in the country. I remember seeing Lyndon Johnson speaking the night of April 4th and lamenting about that this gentle, nonviolent man had been assassinated. This is Lyndon Johnson, who 5 days earlier announced to the country he was not going to run for re-election and that we were going to open peace talks. This is the president who was laying waste to an entire area of Southeast Asia, part of that long, brutal imperialist war. So while presidents engage in a genocidal war against people of color in Vietnam, he's talking about the apostle of nonviolence being struck down. And especially at a point, the same way with Malcolm X, at a point when King was moving toward a much more radical analysis of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation, which he had articulated most fully on April 4th, 1967, exactly 1 year to the day before he died at the Riverside Church in New York. The links between racism and at home and abroad and capitalist exploitation at home and abroad, as did Malcolm before he died. Both were moving increasingly to a radical analysis of this system when they were murdered. They were also both 39 years old when they were killed, as was Che Guevara in October 1967, an oddity of history, all struck down very young in their lives. Of course, we now have the evidence from the released classified FBI files about the COINTELPRO campaign of Hoover and the government against the Black Panther Party, using murder and disruption, provocateurs, the most extensive campaign to destroy a dissident movement in U.S. domestic history, and again, a movement that involved many black veterans of the Vietnam War who had become active in SNCC in the South and in the Black Panther Party. Now this movement, of course, as Zinn shows us, ended de jure of the law segregation and other forms of overt political racism in the country in terms of desegregating facilities, desegregating universities. All you need to do is to look at sports photos of Southern teams in the 1960s as opposed to any major sports team in the 1980s and 90s and now in the beyond 2000. But the persistence of racism and economic exploitation, institutional racism, has continued. Attitudinal racism, no doubt has dropped in this country. People of color have the opportunity, born out of decades of struggle, to stop at motels, to eat in restaurants, et cetera, and to, as was watching last night, this fascinating program on the history of Vegas on the American Experience on PBS, in which the NAACP, with some of the major black entertainers who used to perform in Vegas, sat down with the hotel owners and the politicians in Vegas and gave them the word. I mean, black entertainers like Sammy Davis and Ella Fitzgerald and others could not stay in the hotels they performed at for a long time until those hotels were desegregated. So it was a fascinating little history of Vegas. But the institutional racism in unemployment, in health care, in poverty rates, in child-infant mortality, the more overt forms were smashed by the movement of the 1960s. But the staggering poverty remains in this country and disproportionately affects blacks and Latinos. And if you have any doubt about that, just wander around Santa Monica or downtown LA and see how many people of color are homeless on the streets. Zinn goes on to chapter 19, surprises. So I'm going to focus on this movement, a movement that also brought incredible hysterical responses in the country, and a movement that I would argue ultimately is the potentially the most revolutionary movement within any country and in the world, because we're talking about the majority of the human race. We're not talking about an oppressed minority. In fact, that's often how women were referred to. Women were a minority. Clearly they're not. So you had a resurgence of the women's movement in the 60s, but especially deepening in the 1970s and beyond, even though Friedan's book had come out in 1963 and certainly had an impact. The resurgence, I would say the third phase of the women's movement in the United States, the first phase being the rise of, with Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, the struggle for women's rights in the mid-19th century, and then the resurgence of that again in the early decades of the 20th century during the Progressive Era, leading to finally the constitutional amendment permitting women to vote in 1920. But also the stirrings of the women's movement coming in sometimes out of a negative and positive, sort of negative and positive poles. Many women, of course, active in the student anti-war movement and the civil rights movement, but sadly, but accurately must be stated, not being treated as sisters and comrades in those movements. So some of the effort of women to rise up and to organize the women's liberation movement also came out of their felt grievances at men in movements that wanted to change the world, end the Vietnam War, and yet could not treat women as equal beings within their own movements. Going back a bit to Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, its message was mainly for middle-class women, in a sense, but also uttered or asserted truths that affected all women. It often was called the problem that had no name, the dissatisfaction that women felt being quote-unquote just housewives or mothers, or being limited into few possible professions, often teaching and nursing, essentially living through others, their husbands or children. Even though increasingly women, you know, we remember the going back to World War II, we have all the stories about Rosie the Riveter, millions of women working in the war effort in the United States in the 1940s, and despite many of them being pushed out of the paid labor force, that's what it means to work in this country and other countries, you get paid for it, so therefore all the things that our mothers did, and mothers who may have stayed at home, evidently wasn't work. But women were 40% of the workforce in 1969, but many were secretaries, cleaning workers, waitresses, elementary school teachers, not college professors, and nurses. And the typical woman's job was not well paid, and women often had to endure humiliations directed at their mental capabilities and, of course, to face serious sexual harassment on the job and off the job, which has continued. I mean, it started certainly before Friedan wrote her book. It's been around for a long, long time. It has continued, and of course, it is one of the great, absolute, obscene realities of this society, that is the level of violence against women at the workplace, at home, which is in many ways the most dangerous place for women in this country and other countries. Well, this starts to unravel in terms of the dominant mythology, the challenge to Miss America in Atlantic City in the fall of 68, in which some people argue is the first major sort of event or action of the women's liberation movement, which we must remember, same way with the civil rights movement and the gay movement and the anti-war movement, there's no single monolithic women's movement. There were differences within the women's movement. There were differences across class and race, which black women like Angela Davis and others continued to raise with the women's movement, that often it did not speak to the concerns of poor black women, women on welfare, etc. So this turmoil and conflict begins to also add to the amazing time from the mid-60s and especially into the 70s, when for some people, especially conservatives, they thought this country was literally coming apart. It had a dramatic impact, of course, in universities, in women's studies programs, the challenges to textbooks and how they dealt with females, all the way from elementary school to secondary and into colleges, the changes in courses, to the point now, of course, where the majority of students in American colleges and universities are females, and where increasingly the entering classes in professional schools, medicine, law, etc., are females. Again, in terms of how history changes, it's not as if the textbook authors and or textbook publishers came together and university presidents who were virtually all white males sat down and decided that they should have women's studies programs. This emerged out of the women's movement. This emerged out of challenges, rallies, demonstrations. None of this would have occurred if we had to wait for the dominant group, that is males, to act on these things. The university simply would have not changed. It was the activism and the insight of women in the women's movement that brought about these changes, and of course, as in the struggle for racial equality, joined by some, not too many, males as allies. So you see changes happening officially. You have Lyndon Johnson signing the executive order banning sexual discrimination in federal employment, as did FDR in 1942 with blacks and Truman with segregation in the military in 1948. But this happened because of challenges in organization. Also, there's a brief discussion of an issue that's, of course, still with us and is going to be with us a long time, the issue of choice, the issue of abortion, culminating to some degree with the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973. Again, the Supreme Court being behind public opinion, not leading it, without the rise of the women's movement, without challenges all over the country. It would be hard to argue that the Supreme Court's going to decide that women have the right to choice if there was no movement around it. It only gets codified in law in 1973, but you have to understand the context that brought it about. And of course, it's still with us as we're going to face the confirmation hearings for Judge Alito beginning, I guess they're in January. And all sorts of past decisions and comments he has made about this issue. And this is an issue, again, that I would argue same way with the struggle for racial equality in the United States. This is not an issue that will ultimately be decided by legal decisions and the Supreme Court. This will be decided in communities, in the streets, in the schools, in families, in religious institutions. That's where ultimately the decisions that were codified in law in the 60s that allowed blacks, for example, and again, we go back to Rosa Parks, the Supreme Court in the United States, after Rosa Parks and Montgomery finally got around to saying that it was illegal to discriminate in both municipal and interstate transportation. They didn't say that before Rosa Parks did what she did. The issue of violence I've touched on, certainly reflected in Susan Brown Miller's important work of that time, Against Our Will, Men, Women, and Rape, an issue that with us in this community, that's here in LA, is in every community in the country, it's in every area, urban area, rural area, it's in wealthy neighborhoods, whatever. That is the staggering, staggering total of assault, rapes, and murders of women in the United States. And the arguments that flow from this. And it seems to me that what Brown Miller and other women in the movement argued in the 70s, Kate Millett, among others, Sheila Robotham, Juliet Mitchell, both the two latter, both English feminists, is that the attacks on women are attacks on women as groups, not as individuals. And we would clearly see this if the number of assaults, rapes, and murders of women were done to gay people alone, to blacks alone, to Catholics alone, to other identifiable groups, to priests, to corporate executives, to Jews. We wouldn't see this as some kind of individual problem that emerges out of domestic, I mean, think of the term, domestic abuse. And it says something about how we rank order victims in this society. It's something we started with when we were quoting and discussing David Stannard's book about Columbus. Essentially, what women were arguing for and struggling for is reflected in the quote from the English suffragette Christabel Pankhurst in the early 20th century when she talked about standing up and demanding one's rights and not begging. Do not appeal, do not beg, do not grovel, take courage, join hands, stand beside us, fight with us. I would argue that there's an absolute direct line from this view, from the English feminists of the early 20th century, from the American, the U.S. feminists such as Susan B. Anthony in the 1840s and 50s, to Rosa Parks and the sit-ins in the South in the 60s, Fannie Lou Hamer in Mississippi. The same kind of rising up against authority and challenging oppression. And we saw that especially in the 60s with the rise of poor women, women on welfare, women in demeaning and low-paying jobs, dealing with the immediate issues of hunger and suffering, humiliation, and raising their kids. And the organization, especially in northern ghettos, called the National Welfare Rights League. Untold hundreds of thousands of women were involved in the struggle, and it made a difference in the lives of working and poor women at that time. The militants in the 60s and 70s opened up public welfare policies to gain assistance for women who were essentially being denied that. And they were supported at that time by allies, by men, by women, by other women, by middle and upper middle class women. And the activism of that time about that issue and the lack of it in the 1990s was revealed most profoundly when Clinton and the Republican Congress were able to attack welfare and pass the infamous Welfare Reform Bill of 1996. It simply would not have happened in the 1970s. There would have been such a massive outrage in the country, in the city, such disruptions. Imagine a Democrat, stretching the term, a number of people said Clinton is the best Republican president since World War II. But a Democratic president with a Republican Congress is able to pull off an attack on poor women. And the codes from the 60s, by the way, that started with Nixon, welfare meant black. I can't begin to tell you the number of times I had to go through the data on welfare in the United States with my students, who thought virtually all the people on welfare in the United States were all, of course, driving Cadillacs and not taking care of their kids and spending their food stamp money on liquor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which you can't do, to tell them that overwhelmingly the people on welfare were white, and especially in upstate New York, they did not have an average of 12.37 kids per family, et cetera, et cetera. Well, all of the code terms that we use to attack essentially poor women who are disproportionately black, that was revealed in the kind of code terms we saw in 1996. And Reagan was not able to pull that off, by the way, in the 1980s, and neither was George Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush. That happened under Mr. Clinton and the Republicans. And of course, a final note on that, with all of the mythology and all of the hype about people on welfare, people don't want to work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They just want to sit around and turn out babies so they get loads and loads of money. You know, when people would do the research and would show that in the most, quote unquote, the states with the highest benefits, such as New York and California, it was such a meager amount. It was incredible. And in states like Mississippi and Alabama, it was so low as to be an outrage. So we saw what happened. And in a sense, it was able to happen because the militant movement that emerged, especially around race and social justice in the 50s and 60s, was not tied to the militant movement that arose in the women's movement in the 70s to fight what was an absolute assault on the least of us. When, if you compared all the monies that go to federal food stamps and welfare at the state and federal level, they're dwarfed by the handouts to major corporations and the Pentagon. It's not even a contest. We talk about who are the real welfare chiselers in the country. But they were able to pull that off, you know, to end welfare in our time. Okay, let's stop. Let's take a break, and we'll come back to discuss this in about 10 minutes or so. I remember my high school history teacher, my senior year, he used to bring in magazines, and I remember he used to bring in the New Republic, which then, this is 1958, was a pretty liberal magazine. It's now pretty right of liberal. But so I try to share things that I get. I get too many, far too many magazines. But, so, do you want to say anything about Addicted to War, in terms of the group? Those who don't have it here,
I thought it would be appropriate to bring it in because I expected more people, and I didn't know we had so much competition tonight.
Yeah.
Since this book, the main topic is our national obsession with war, I thought it would be kind of appropriate to give it out to people and have them bone up on that along with the next chapter. And
great.
I think it's a great book that makes people think that there is another aspect to why we go to war. And it revolves around Manifest Destiny. And it seems to be our national obsession of why we keep going to war and why we want to create an empire. So anybody's welcome to take one home and read it. And if you like it, bring me back $5. If you don't, bring it back and I'll get it to somebody else.
Well, thank you. And I got to check. I'm pretty sure I have a copy. I may take a copy and give you some money. I saw Frank Durrell over the weekend, but I thought I heard that more than 100,000 of these are actually out around the country.
300,000.
$300,000. Wow. I mean, I wish we had that in the early parts of the anti-war movement in the Vietnam War. I mean, the graphics are great, the information, it's tight. I mean, this just millions should be in the country, in high schools, and everywhere, because this is the kind of popular, you know, it's not dense, it's clear, it's historically accurate. It's really an outstanding, outstanding work. So
yeah, and the guy who wrote it, he was a sociology PhD candidate at UCLA, and now I think he's teaching at, is there John Hopkins University?
Yeah.
There is, yeah. I think he's teaching there now.
Wow,
so
from LA to Baltimore.
It looks like a children's book, but it's like you say, historically accurate. And he's got the footnotes to back up everything he claims within the book.
Yeah, it's really.
And it's got that quote from Smedley Butler in it, too.
Yeah. Okay, so let's discuss these two chapters and the time we have remaining. And maybe we'll start with the women's movement or the civil rights struggle.
You had said that it was vital that the Supreme Court decision on Brown versus Topeka was unanimous. What do you think would have happened if the decision was 7-2 in favor?
Well, I probably should have clarified that. I mean, I think it was sort of the icing on the cake that it was unanimous. Probably should have made it clear that if it had not gone in a positive way, if the Supreme Court had not declared segregation unconstitutional, or let's say it was 5-4, I mean, the fallout in terms of world opinion would have been disastrous. Not that it was going to change what actually went on, especially in the South, in terms of how black people were treated, but in terms of people around the world, very alert to what was going on. I mean, the United States was the dominant world power, despite all the mythology that, you know, the Soviets had so much power, et cetera, et cetera. Not that it was a foregone conclusion, because in reading some histories of that struggle, there were at least two justices who were leaning against voting, were going to possibly vote against it, and, you know, I think I forget who the chief justice, well, Warren was the chief justice, but somebody else on the court. You know, they get together, these people, and they were all guys. They were all white guys then. This is pre-Thurgood Marshall, who, of course, was the attorney for the parents, they did some politicking, and they were aware. I think it's Justice Douglas or somebody said, we read the newspaper, same way now. Some of you may think that not everyone on the Supreme Court, this Supreme Court does read the newspaper, or can, but I won't mention any names, but they read the newspaper, they are aware of what's going on in the United States, and they are aware of the battles around Roe v. Wade and around other issues, around the treatment of prisoners at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. So they were reading the papers in 1954 and aware of the Cold War that was going on. So you have to see it in that context.
And what do you think would happen? The fallout within the United States?
The fallout...
Within the United States, had it been a close decision?
Well, I think that, I mean, it would have been a temporary setback, but clearly would not have derailed the struggle that was emerging. Again, this is May 17th, 1954. I'm thinking of something. I'll share with you a little anecdote, which will only go to prove that I'm kind of a fanatic about dates, but maybe obsessive. So this is roughly a year before Rosa Parks doesn't move on the bus and the emergence of the Montgomery bus boycott. So I think it would have, certainly in terms of giving legitimacy to the effort, the civil rights, I think they were human rights efforts, it would have certainly been a defeat, but it would not have stopped what was unfolding in the southern United States. And even if the Supreme Court had ruled against and had blocked things, I mean, I think you still would have had thousands of people getting arrested in this movement. It never relied, I mean, Zinn has been very clear about that in every single thing I've ever read by him about the courts, that it ultimately, in fact, I think one of the latest issues of The Progressive, he's got a short essay, we can't rely on the Supreme Court to bring us our rights. So
I'd like to get some of your take on the hierarchy in the Catholic Church and their, quote, cautions regarding feminism and women's liberation and stuff. The whole feminist movement brought us so much. We gained so much from it. We've still got a lot of ways to go, but always the hierarchy in the church was very negative towards the whole movement.
Let me just throw it back to you for a minute and just begin to share with us a little bit of what we were talking about in the break and your views, and then I'll just compliment what we were talking about, or compliment the kind of assertions that you're going to make.
You mean regarding the what we achieved, or what?
Well, what you think about this whole struggle with feminism and the church.
And the church? Well, first of all, I'm totally mystified by it. And secondly, what I look at is the power structure. And I distrust power greatly. And certainly the hierarchy in the church has a great deal of power. And they don't want women around giving their opinions and making claims and stuff like that. Certainly, they're also terribly hung up on sex. And I think that with the women's movement, as well as the sexual revolution through the 60s, I think that the church probably looked at that as one and the same, is my guess. Yeah. But there's always been this thing of be very cautious of feminism. There's a lot of negatives there, but I never could quite figure out what they were.
Right. Quickly to jump back to the comment I made about obsessions and dates, and then I want to respond. 1997, I was in Cooperstown, New York at the Baseball Hall of Fame. I used to go, for a number of years, I went to a very serious academic conference on baseball. There are a whole bunch of baseball nuts running around the country who, you know, English professors at the University of Rochester, whose life revolved around every P piece of film dealing with baseball, but they were wonderful, wonderful conferences. And in 1997 was the 50th anniversary of Jackie Robinson breaking in with the Brooklyn Dodgers. So our conferences were allowed to use the Hall of Fame. They were always in early June, and it was great. None of the kids are out of school. Cooperstown, New York's a beautiful little town. So we had total access to the hall. And so there was this exhibit and a whole ceremony. Rachel Robinson was there, Carl Erskine, for you folks who are not baseball fans, right-handed pitcher for the Dodgers. God, I remember when he struck out 15 Yankees in the World Series, I was heartbroken. And Joe Morgan, the Hall of Famer from Cincinnati, was now a broadcaster. So before they had the ceremony, a few of us who were in the conference got to walk through the exhibit. And all these amazing plaques on the wall. So I'm walking through, and there's a plaque about Jackie Robinson and the changes in the civil rights movement and Brown versus Board of Education, which they had as May 17th, 1955. So we had to ask the curator to come over. I mean, I felt kind of bad because it was already chiseled in this beautiful plaque to say it was actually May 17th, 1954, which was also, by the way, the date of the Geneva Conference that ended the Vietnam War, okay? So, and all around the Battle of Dien Bien Phu and what was happening in Vietnam. So, that's my obsession about dates. But I totally agree with you. I think that when you think about it, here's a group of guys who live in this place that's, what, a mile square, whatever. I mean, I've been in the Vatican. With all this wealth, and where the only women who are allowed there are the women, Italian women, or they may be transient immigrant women now in Italy, and more people who do the dirty work in Italy are not native to the countries, but from North Africa, etc. The only women allowed in the Vatican are those who cook the meals for the cardinals and the other people who work there. It's a city of just guys. And it is certainly one of the most powerful institutions on the planet. In real power, it's about the third century, talking 1700 years. I think it's perhaps the most reactionary totalitarian institution on the planet. And they have a great deal to fear from feminism, if we mean feminism as the substantive equality between men and women on this earth, and the respect and dignity women should be afforded on the basis of the content of their character. And that is a threat to the power of the cardinals and of the Pope. We've seen that especially with the late Pope, Pope John Paul, and I don't see any difference coming out of the new Pope, Benedict. And their attitudes about women, their attitudes about women in the church, their attitudes about women, in a sense, being secondary to men. And despite all of this, you know, this putting Mary, especially in the Roman Catholic Church, my latent anti-Catholicism, I was just baptized and that was it. I guess I'm a lapsed Catholic, is that what they call us? They have been an institution that has blocked. They have opposed every single major advance for women, and they block things in the UN. I mean, they have an observer status in the United Nations. No other religious group has that, by the way. They have blocked Planned Parenthood efforts. They have gone to conferences in the world and used their influence, in addition to reactionary US officials, to block changes that have caused catastrophic loss of life, especially in Africa. But they have not been able to block some of the major changes that women have advanced. Not even in Italy, by the way. All right? There's a very strong feminist movement in Italy. And they really have the seat of the Roman Catholic Church in Italy. But a lot of Italians, you know, they don't even bother with, hey, don't worry about it. So that battle is going to continue. And I don't think it's an accident that probably the two of the strongest people, I mean, if Alito gets on the Supreme Court, or Scalito as they're calling him, you're going to have two Italian Americans who are Roman Catholics who are going to oppose many, I would argue, worthwhile efforts that would advance the equal rights of women in this society. And they're going to do what they're going to do. They have not been able to block the changes you mentioned, and they're not going to. I mean, women are going to continue to move into the economy, women are going to continue to knock down barriers, etc. It's a movement that is not going to go back, just like the civil rights movement's not going, despite people wanting to do that. We're not going back to apartheid America. Those days are over. So.
I was just thinking another thing more than, well, I guess it still has to do with the power, but along with feminism, of course, was the pill and contraception, which is a big no-no, but 98% of Catholic married women practice birth control, and decreasing the sizes of their families, but also divorce. With the feminist movement and with laws being changed where women could apply for divorce, it wasn't just the man, and so that divorce then skyrocketed, partly, I believe, because of that, as well as other reasons. But it's almost like a lot of the teachings of the church would fall apart with feminism.
That's what I'm saying. I think that if we truly moved toward equal relations between men and women in this society and across the world, I mean, and again, the greatest growth of the Roman Catholic population is not in the United States, but is actually in what we refer to as the Third World, in Asia and Africa and Latin America. If the efforts that emerged in the 60s and 70s continued to deepen, it is a threat to the hierarchical power of the Roman Catholic Church. And I would argue, by the way, that this is where I have a sort of a comradely disagreement with women in all of the religious institutions who are trying to knock down the doors. On one hand, there's a sympathy. On the other hand, the very hierarchical nature of the church, to me, militates. It's a profoundly unequal institution, and it's not going to be made equal if you have more women in it. I'd make the same argument about corporations. I mean, they are inherently hierarchical, as universities are. So let's say all of the major corporations, the CEOs, are women. It still does not change the relationships from top to bottom. So if you end up, and you could imagine, I mean, we can let our imaginations run wild. So let's say in the far, far distant future, a woman becomes pope. And the church, I mean, if we look at church history, the church has had to change. But there are interesting links, though. The church has had a long, long, centuries-long history of anti-Semitism, and only recently come to grips with what its policies were and its ideology toward Jews. It had a long history of condoning slavery and what happened in the Americas. It's had and it continues to have a history of virulent homophobia against gay men and women. And yet all of those things are ultimately going to change. So it'll be interesting to see how the church, in terms of doctrine, I mean, they're going to have to go back and find some obscure text that some pope wrote in 1239 that we're supposed to treat people equal. Because if you follow church doctrine, then it seems to me that they wouldn't change. Okay.
Hi, two-parter. The first part is, you mentioned the stamps that were to honor Paul Robeson and then the Tuskegee Airmen. I do not think that we should divert our attention and our energies into symbolic gestures, but into practical action. And I think that when Rosa Parks was honored, wherever she was honored on her death, it disgusted me, because shortly before she was honored in such a way, the people in New Orleans, I think she would rather not have been honored in such a way, more honored if she had not had to witness what she saw and what's happening now, and she knows what's happening now, even though she's not here. I do not think that we should be distracted by falling into this trap of trying to extract these kind of honors from the elites, and really, really keep our focus on what's really important and practically, and being practical about what we really need to spread the wealth. So that's the first thing.
Well, I would agree and disagree. I would agree in the sense that we should not allow symbolic representations of equality to divert us from deeper concerns. And here you're speaking specifically of African Americans, and how, in terms of, again, employment, in terms of environmental degradation, which affects black communities more than any communities in the country, especially in urban areas, in terms of, as I said, infant mortality, health care, disease, that those are, I'm sure if people had a choice, they would rather have those things taken care of, and they would give up the stamps. At the same time, symbols are important. Let me, you know, link it to baseball. I mean, the nature of baseball, the nature of the ownership of baseball, what the game represents, was not fundamentally changed by Jackie Robinson playing, because I couldn't stand Jackie Robinson and the rest of the Dodgers, but that's a whole other issue. Look at, my father brought me to Yankee Stadium when I was 6 or 7. I grew up in Brooklyn, but that's the first place I went to see a game, and I was hooked. What can I tell you? And I rooted for Joe DiMaggio. But I remember talking about this issue with, I'm blanking, Brian Milton's son, who worked on that Paul Rowe, Mark Rogovin, who lives in Chicago, and going around the country and talking to people about this and trying to get change minds and recognize Paul Robeson. So these symbols, I think, are important as a step in the right direction, provided, as you're saying, we don't say, you know, we've got a stamp, or wow, now Rosa Parks
lies in state.
Right. And there were people, of course, in the country and people who said things at ceremonies honoring her and in Washington and who filed past her casket in the Capitol, who were genuinely moved by what she did in this life. And of course, we don't want to be diverted to think that Bush and other major figures who've spent their whole lives blocking everything that she fought for cared one hoot about her or that struggle. So in that sense, you're right. As long as we put it in the perspective that it deserves.
The second part, I want to talk about sexuality, the issue of the church and sexuality. We talk about make love, not war, but I really think we need to start making love. And we need to encourage people to start making love. And we maybe, it just occurred to me while I was listening to this exchange, that maybe we should try to get the legislators to decriminalize the act of sex publicly, and whatever they're criminalizing sex all over the place, you know, as a start. And really encourage people to start having responsible sex. And the more sex they have responsibly, the less war they'll be making.
Well, that was the, you know, remember the statement, you know, from the 60s, make love, not war.
We really just encourage it, teach them how to do it.
And that, I mean, the feminist movement, the, you know, we call it the sexual revolution, whatever term you want to use, that as an essential part of our lives, and heavenly our parents' lives, otherwise we wouldn't be here, that too is a threat to the repression of not just the Roman Catholic Church. And again, when you look at some of the traditions within Islam, within Judaism, and within Christianity, and thinking of the three great religions of the West, and the treatment of women, and in terms of women being able to act out and freely enhance their lives in a positive way, we are sexual beings. That has been a centuries-long struggle. I mean, you go back and read some of the church fathers in the Catholic Church, or read Martin Luther and the attitudes about women and sexuality and the witches and burning them. And I mean, it curl your hair. That's still with us.
Right. Yeah. What really triggered the whole thing was, a thought process in my mind was the fact that the missionaries were just... they couldn't believe the free sexuality, this wonderful sexuality, this overt sexuality among indigenous peoples wherever they went. And they needed to suppress it all, and that's how they were able to control people. And that's what I mean. It's really very important to reclaim the sexuality that we've all lost so that we can reclaim our power. It's not funny. It's really, really important.
Oh, no.
This is a tool that the church uses, joined with the state, to control the population.
Well, the church has lost dramatic power to control people's sexuality over the last, let's say, if we go back to 1970, the reemergence of the women's movement, the Roman Catholic Church and other traditional churches have been getting battered. All you got to do is watch MTV and watch young people on campuses and know what's going on in the country. They have lost the sexual revolution. I mean, when Pat Buchanan, conservatives as he is, says, listen, the liberals and, you know, the counterculture, they've won the culture wars. That's one of the reasons why the Roman Catholic Church, I mean, I don't think it's an accident that John Paul II ended up being pope when he did, or this conservative pope was also affirmed as pope, dramatically different in some ways than Pope John the 23rd in the early 60s. They're trying to hold the line because increasingly they're being challenged on every front in terms of their policy about gay people, their policy about women. It's a battle, though. This is a major, major institution. And sexuality, you're right, is part of the battle. And it's going to continue. They're going to ultimately lose it. The problem is, over the course of time, think of the hundreds of millions of people who have suffered, who have been told that they're demeaned or their sexuality is this, or, you know, by an institution that ordains people, some of whom, of course, are genuinely committed to what they believe in, but as we know, have also engaged in incredibly abusive behavior against their own flock. Just take a look at how long Mahoney here in Los Angeles have been trying to block the DA from having all these files, and the money being handed out by the Roman Catholic Church, the parishes being closed in the United States, disproportionately in poor neighborhoods, of course, not in the suburbs. That whole cultural war, of which they want to blame women for, they can't look at themselves and say, our institution is oppressive, and if women were the ones that fundamentally pointed it out, they should be congratulated. You're not going to get the College of Cardinals to do that. I mean, they can't. They can't look in the mirror. We're talking about big-time denial here. Ooh, man, you'd need 100 Freuds to analyze those guys.
I graduated in 1969, so it was like the middle of the whole of all this stuff going on. And one of the things I noticed that I was kind of disappointed in was that he dealt with a lot of the different movements that went on in the time, but not very much. In fact, I don't recall much of anything on the Chicano or Mexicano movement that was right. So extremely important here in the Southwest. And, of course, for the rest of the country, with Cesar Chavez, the Mechas, all the various things. Being involved in the anti-war movement and justice movements in the colleges and stuff, I mean, they were like the pivot of almost everything that went on. They were the ones that basically united, like, the African-Americans and the whites in the different struggles and things. And I was really disappointed that Zinn didn't really cover that. You know, I don't even recall anything that he said about them at all, even when any little notch that he mentioned. So I was kind of disappointed with that.
That's a good point. And I think in some interview that they had with Howard about, you know, what would he do differently, and again, there may be another edition that's forthcoming, it was this bipolar black and white, as if there are not other Latino groups, Asian Americans in this country, in terms of the movements, that might have been, of course, much more prominent and focused in some parts of the country rather than others. But the same way about the black movement. I mean, again, we think of the South, we think of urban areas, we don't think about Idaho and Wyoming. So, you know, I think that's a legitimate criticism that he's had to recognize. Yeah, that's how we thought about race, black people and white people. Racism was about oppression to African Americans, as if there were no other racially oppressed groups in the country. And in terms of what especially happening in the cities, where the real powerful conflict emerged, but, you know, it also emerged out here and in Texas, Arizona, etc.
Okay, well, so far you've covered in the civil rights and during the 60s, you've covered blacks and African Americans, and slightly you've covered Latinos, but so far you haven't talked that much about, I don't think you've even mentioned Asians or Native Americans. Where were they in the picture?
Well, there's not much discussion. To follow what Jim had to say, there's not much discussion, though there is some, about the rising American Indian movement in the United States in the late 60s and early 70s. And thinking about that, and for those of you who may not have seen, the LA Times had an obituary today on Vine Deloria Jr., who died, you know, wrote Custer Died for Your Sins, and one of the leading voices among American Indians in the country. He had retired from the University of Colorado in the year 2000. Also had a theology, I didn't know some of this, I read the obit. Actually, some of the best columns written in American newspapers are the obit columns, by the way. I mean, they're serious and they write and you learn about history and they're usually free of all this ideological crap. Well, he also had a theology degree and a law degree. So there's some discussion in these two chapters about the American Indian movement and the taking over of Alcatraz, Attica. I didn't focus on that in that chapter because I deliberately wanted to focus on the issues of women. I was in upstate New York in 1971 when Attica exploded, and followed it night and day, and later had, you know, we had some people who had been in the prison come to classes, and someone I knew who was active in a number of things in Ithaca, New York, was in the yard at Attica when the state troopers came in and killed people. In fact, his best friend was killed right next to him. So Zinn touches on those, but there's no discussion of the rising Asian American movement, which I think he would probably argue would be more later 70s, 80s, and 90s, for a number of reasons, of which I'm not sure, because we know that there were connections between Mexican and Mexican-American workers and Japanese-American workers in California dating back to the 20s and 30s. So that's an area that certainly needed more meat, though maybe Jim could enlighten us a bit further.
There was Asian-American organizations going on in my class, I remember they were early 1970, there was Asian American organizations that were forming to deal with Asian oppression. So, I mean, it was going on quite early.
And they were all of these, I mean, that's what's amazing, all of these movements, it's as if they all arose at the same time. Though a number of people, I mean, again, we don't want to get into a ranking, but a number of people argue that it's really the spark that lit the prairie fire was lit in the South by Rosa Parks and blacks, and that's had such a profound impact on everything. For example, in the anti-war movement, long before the first March on Washington against the war by the Students for a Democratic Society, April 17, 1965, remember I was there, there were SNCC workers, young people in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the South in 1963 and 4 who were already militantly against the war in Vietnam. And a lot of people didn't even know there was a war in Vietnam, saying, you know, we have no rights in Mississippi. You want to send us to Vietnam? You know, sort of typified or symbolized when Muhammad Ali was stripped of his title when he said, you know, no Viet Cong ever called me a nigger, quote unquote, to use that N-word, which I don't like to use, but to repeat accurately what he said. So blacks were being, I mean, if Mississippi was sort of the hell on earth in the United States, the worst place for African Americans, though not fundamentally different from other parts of the country, as Malcolm X always argued, that he said, you know, the Mason-Dixon line started at the Canadian border, not in the South. Everywhere is the South. And those movements have continued, and they did make a difference in the quality of life in this country. I mean, that's Noam Chomsky's argument, that those movements helped civilize this country, because we had official apartheid before those movements. I mean, there was no doubt about that.
One little comment about Rosa Parks was that, I remember it was on the radio, 2 weeks after 9/11, Rosa Parks, Danny Glover, and Harry Belafonte led a demonstration in New York of 2,000 people against any kind of military action against any countries. It was like one of the first anti-war actions that was done around the Bush administration activity.
Wow. And of course, I mean, again, she'd been doing these kinds of things for a long time. And of course, Harry Belafonte for decades, and now Danny Glover, Lena Horne. And Belafonte, of course, has taken a lot of grief because he also tied together civil rights and anti-war. He's been very active in the anti-war, anti-imperialist movement. Curtis, we're going to give you the last word again tonight.
Thank you. You know, talking about Rosa Parks, I always forget myself. I mean, it's so easy for me to get very narrow in my thinking. I don't see beyond this country. I don't see the struggles in this country as really just being part of a struggle around the world, people around the world. And there's one incident in Rosa Parks' life that apparently meant a whole lot to her, and when I read it a number of years ago, it meant a lot to me. And in honor of Rosa Parks, who I liked a lot, you know, from afar. In the, you know, early 90s, she's living in Detroit. She'd stopped working for Congressman Conyers, you know, so she was kind of forgotten. And Nelson Mandela was coming to town. I think it was his first American visit after being set free in the early 90s, I think 91, 92, something like that. And he was making a stop on his U.S. tour. He was making a stop in Detroit. And so the mayor and, you know, other dignitaries in Detroit were lining up, let's welcome this guy. No one bothered to invite Rosa Parks. And she knew Mandela was coming, and she kind of was hoping someone would invite her to be part of the welcoming thing. And finally, someone said, oh, yeah, yeah, let's invite her. So they had her down right at the tarmac, right there. And actually, she was, I think, maybe the third in the row behind the, maybe the mayor and a congressperson. And she was there in this welcoming line. And so Nelson Mandela gets off the plane. And of course, the crowd goes wild, and he comes down the steps. And as he's coming down the steps, he looks at this welcoming line, and his eyes go to Rosa Parks, and he walks direct, and Rosa Parks has never, you know, met this man, you know, he's a world hero, but he goes right up to her and stands right in front of her and grabs her, and he says to her, he starts chanting, Rosa Parks, Rosa Parks,
wow.
Rosa Parks. And what he later shared was that during 55, when this thing happened in America, in Montgomery, in South Africa, this was utterly empowering, and there were black in the streets in South Africa chanting Rosa Parks, Rosa Parks, Rosa Parks. So, I mean, it really kind of blew her away, because even with all her fame, and to realize the impact that her life had on people across the world, it was really something.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Curtis. I had never heard that, and that's really, get chills. Thank you. See you next month. Thank you. Wow, what a moment. I wonder, that must be captured on films.
You have been listening to Dr. John Marciano's presentation called Or Does It Explode? And Surprises, commentary and discussions of Chapter 17 and 19 of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. The group met on November 15th of 2005. Every month, a group led by Dr. Marciano meets to discuss individual chapters. They meet at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.